Joining us in a little while is going to be a comics writer, Simeon Aston. Comics artist, Simeon Aston. And he's going to be talking about his exciting, it's a steampunk, cyberpunk comic book series that he started with another writer called Jeremy Biggs. But before we get to that, Raisa's joining me. We're going to go over some news. So, Raisa, I'm going to take it right over to you because I know that you're pretty excited about something.
Yes, I'm pretty excited about the fact, or potentially excited, let's say, about the fact that BBC Three has announced a Doctor Who spinoff. Now, granted, it's not the spinoff a number of fans wanted, but it's a spinoff, which means they're not out of the spinoff business. They've announced that the spinoff is going to be entitled Class, and it's a YA series set in contemporary London. It's in incredible dangers are breaking through the walls of time and space, and with darkness coming, London is unprotected. With all these, with all the action, heart, and adrenaline of the best YA fiction, and they mentioned Buffy the Vampire Slayer and The Hunger Games. This is Cohill School and Doctor Who like you've never seen them before. So it's basically the students of Cohill School without the Doctor, and that's presumably without Clara, and they're going to be facing all this stuff. And it's going to basically be, my impression, it's going to be basically Sarah Jane Adventures for an older audience than Sarah Jane Adventures.
It's a pity they didn't think of this sooner, because, you know, they could have sort of straight off the back of Sarah Jane Adventures finishing, they could have retained the remaining actors and had them attending Cohill School.
Yes, I thought about that. Hindsight's 2020. They could have done a lot of things, but they didn't do. The one issue I had with this is that they're basically building a spinoff around, frankly, the least interesting aspect of season 7. I mean season 8. I hope that the writing beefs it up some. I hope that they actually have at least a cameo, if not a recurring role, for Ian Chesterton, who is the head of the Board of Governors of Cohill School, according to the sign in the front of the school, and that they actually find a role for William Russell, who is, bless his heart, still with us.
True, and also might I just add there, for the newly initiated Doctor Who fans that don't know anything about the 50 years of continuity that actually comes before, William Russell played, as Raisa pointed out, Ian Chesterton, and he was one of the first companions for the Doctor, along with Barbara and the Doctor's then daughter, Susan.
Granddaughter, yes. Yes, They started out as Susan's teachers. Susan and the Doctor were hiding on Earth, and he was trying his best to give Susan something like a normal life and not doing the whole gallivanting thing every nanosecond. And so she was attending Cohill School, and that's how we meet her. And two of her teachers follow her into the TARDIS. They just sort of accidentally stumble into the TARDIS following her, and that's how the series starts.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful.
I think this series could be interesting, though. I mean, as you say, it's based on the least interesting aspects of season 8, but, you know, we didn't really spend that much time in Cohill. We had that one episode where we spent all that time in Cohill, but it wasn't really the strongest episode of season 8 either.
So, no, it wasn't.
You know, and, you know, from what I hear, this guy, Patrick Ness, is really good at what he does. So, you know, I'm willing to give it a try. I'm quite happy to give it a try. I would like to see William Russell come back as Ian Chesterton, even if it's just sort of maybe for a brief walk-on. You know, it'd be great to see him come back. And a little bit of an update for you. It's being made, it's going to be shown on BBC Three, which next year, when this starts, BBC Three is only going to be available on the internet. But from what I've heard, and this is something that Patrick Ness has said himself, they're going to be showing the first episode a week after on BBC One. So it will have a chance of trying to capture that bigger Who audience sort of thing.
Cool.
So,
it also means that those of us can also see it over on this side of the pond.
Mhm. Yeah. Well, you know, so like, I guess that's a way of opening up to BBC America, as well. You know, I'm sort of like I'm cautiously excited. You know, I mean, so like, as I would be for any spin-off. You know, so it'd just be interesting to see what they do with it. Anyway,
yeah,
I've got a bit of news for you. This is something that broke yesterday. Apparently HBO are looking into a Zack Snyder Watchmen TV series. HBO are looking to expand their range of fantasy series and have been looking at the potential of a TV series based on Alan Moore's popular Watchmen comic book series. In 2009, Zack Snyder did a movie adaptation which proved to be a mammoth uphill struggle for him due to the comic book's interconnected and referential storylines. In fact, it's a minor miracle that Snyder was able to make the film at all, given the amount of material that is in the comic books. It's with all this in mind that Snyder has approached HBO with a view to having a second bite at Watchmen Cherry, but for television. Various sources and reports have revealed that Snyder has taken a few meetings with execs at HBO to try and sell them on the idea. As to whether the series will be a reimagining of the movie or a prequel series or even a sequel series remains to be seen. No firm plans have been made as yet, with HBO being as business savvy as they are. I doubt we'll hear anything concrete about this until such times as they actually get a series before cameras, if indeed things get that far. I'm kind of a bit ambiguous about this. I'm not sure what your take of it is, because I thought it's watching a movie.
Having read both the novel, it's one of the few graphic novels I've actually physically read, and seen the movie, I didn't think the movie stuck as badly as it could have. I thought that structurally speaking, the movie was actually pretty sound. That said, if they're going to do this, TV is the better medium for it, provided they get writers who actually know what they're doing.
And the budget, of course.
Yes. Yes.
Because they'd need a budget, you know, it needs to be pretty damn close to what they did in the film, with effects-wise sort of thing. But,
if only for Dr. Manhattan, if nothing else, they've got to render him properly.
Mm-hmm. But then again, Dr. Manhattan kind of dies at the end of the film, doesn't he? Sort of like he doesn't die as such. He just wanders off.
He wanders off and decides to actually become a god, which I actually adore. He's actually my favorite character in The Watchmen, just because he's unapologetically a Deus Ex Machina. Because they always tell you, whenever you're taking creative writing courses or whenever you're doing anything creative writing-wise, don't write a Deus Ex Machina. And there are reasons for that, because you don't want you to be out. But what if you actually create a character who is intrinsically a Deus Ex Machina and then explore that? I always respected Moore for actually going down that road so well and completely. Manhattan is exactly what he needs to be.
You know, given Alan Moore's attitude to the press and attitude to the comic book industry in general, although admittedly he did get screwed over quite a bit by DC and Marvel, but, you know, given his attitude generally, because he's not the only person that's been screwed over, they screwed over pretty much everybody sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But given his attitude to them, it wouldn't surprise me if Dr. Manhattan in some way was actually based on himself.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that makes a kind of sense, yeah.
You know, but, you know, I'm not going to ring an egg on that, but I am actually scared now because apparently Alan Moore practices magic, so hopefully he doesn't have internet access. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't take anything away from him. He's a damn good writer. You know, so those character studies were fantastic, and yeah, DC and Marvel did screw him over, but you know, like I said, they screwed everyone over.
Yeah, it's not, you know, he shouldn't take it personally because it's just how they are.
Yeah, that sounds like you're condoning DC and Marvel being assholes.
Well, it's not that I'm condoning. It's just that what are you going to do beyond a certain point? You can just sue them and hope for the best.
I can do what Matt Mingar did and settle your own comic books company and you know, start launching your own creator-owned stuff.
That's true. If you can do that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the difference is between Mark Millar and Alan Moore is like the worlds apart. I think Moore's actually probably a stronger writer, whereas but the thing is with Moore, he tends to avoid the press, whereas Millar sort of embraces the media and knows how to use it, you know, to his own ends, which is really cool. And the great thing about Millar is he's just sort of like such a nice, humble guy as well. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what I found, but yeah, it's interesting, and no doubt Alan Moore will not be interested in the TV spin-off because he's got no interest in anything that's like produced outside of the comic book realm, really, which is a shame, because can you imagine the sort of input and contribution that he could make?
Yeah.
It'd be awesome. It'd just be totally awesome if you could contribute to it. Anyway, moving on, I think you've got another story, haven't you? It's a Big Finish one.
Yes. Big Finish, this is about an existing production that Big Finish is presenting for sale that's already aired on BBC Radio 4. And it's a production of The Martian Chronicles starring Sir Derek Jacobi and Hayley Atwell. Yes. Sir Derek Jacobi, of course, played the Master, and he also played the Master for the Doctor Who production, Scream of the Shalka, and he's also done some stuff for Big Finish prior to this. And Big Finish is delighted to announce a special release of B7 Media's acclaimed dramatization of Ray Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles this December.
Mm-hmm.
The new drama, originally broadcast on BBC Radio 4, stars Jacobi and Hayley Atwell as the leaders of an expedition to Mars tasked with a secret mission. On the first expedition to Mars mysteriously disappears, Earth sends a second to find out what happened, but the real mission is classified, and only Captain Wilder knows the truth. Spender is an anthropologist on Wilder's crew and attempts to prevent the colonization that she believes will eradicate the last of the ancient people living on Mars.
Uh-huh.
But to what lengths will she go? As an honorable but duty-bound Captain Wilder tracks the now rogue Spender under the Martian mountains, and the future of this ancient planet is at stake. Meanwhile, Earth itself teeters on the brink of its own global catastrophe as the very survival of humanity hangs in the balance. The adaptation recently won the Silver Award for Best Drama Special at the 2015 New York Festival's International Radio Program Awards. Alistair Locke was also nominated for Best Sound Design, the 2014 Radio Production Awards, and the release was produced by Patrick Chapman and directed by Andrew Mark Sewall. And it sounds absolutely great. I saw that it was on BBC Four. I listened to BBC Four fairly regularly, but I didn't have time for it at the time. So I'll try and see if I can fit it on my review schedule this December. Although December is chock-a-block.
Mm. Well, the only Martian Chronicles I ever remember. I mean, I've never read the book, but the only thing I ever remember is they did a mini series of it with Rock Hudson back in the 70s.
I saw that. Years ago, I saw it.
It was so, it didn't really air here in the UK till around about 1983. I think BBC Two picked it up and they ran it over a series of weeks, but it was at such a time where I'd actually started going somewhere. I can't remember where it was I was going, some sort of youth club or something that I'd started going to, and it was always on when I was at the youth club sort of thing, so I never actually got to see it sort of thing. And to this day, I still haven't seen it.
Well, I've read some of his Martian stuff, but I actually prefer his fantasy, some of his stuff like Something Wicked This Way Comes and stuff like that. But I've read some of his Martian stuff. This should be interesting.
Yeah, he did a film of that as well, Something Wicked This Way Comes. I, you know, it's kind of surprised me that, you know, sci-fi, I've never actually done a remake of Martian Chronicles. It's just as evocative as Dune or any of those series. That, you know, because they had a lot of success with Dune when they did that, so why not Martian Chronicles?
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, but this should be good.
Well, I'm probably going to put that on my list, or is it on yours already?
No, you can go ahead and put it on yours. My December is already taken up for me with stuff. I've already picked out mine. Put it in my Dropbox when you're done.
I will do. In a little bit more news, this is about the show called Powers, which I've still not seen, because for some reason you can't get it on, you know, in Sony PlayStation Europe at the moment. But Michael Madsen scored a role as a supervillain in the Powers TV series. Powers is to return to the Sony PlayStation Network for a second series, and joining the cast will be Michael Madsen, who is to play the villainous Super Shock. Madsen, of course, is best known for his various roles in movies such as Species, Kill Bill 1 and 2, and Reservoir Dogs. So he has plenty of experience when it comes to playing the tough guy. PlayStation and Sony Pictures Television official description for the character defines him as a perfect physical specimen with an unparalleled presence that catapulted him to global fame. After retiring at the height of his career under mysterious circumstances and disappearing from public view, he emerges for the first time in 40 years after the death of Retro Girl. Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Oeming, the co-creators of Powers comic series, announced Super Shock would join the show at this past Comic Con International in San Diego. At the time, no one had been cast in the role. Super Shock is the most powerful superhero in the Powers universe, Bendis explained. With him comes a whole new set of problems and achievements. With Retro Girl's death, Super Shock comes out of wherever he's been, and we will discover a lot about the Powers universe through him and Walker and Dina's relationship. This is the biggest superhero in the world. Superheroes were named after him. He never took an advertisement dollar. He never was in product placement. He kept it pure for decades and decades, he added. So is he a villain or a hero?
I've read both, but I'm not familiar with Powers, so I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's just that, you know, the headline there and elsewhere where I've read it has him tagged as a villain. So maybe he kind of broke bad because he didn't get to do product placement or anything and didn't get any money for all his public appearances. Maybe
something like Ozymandias, yeah.
Maybe he got a case of the Walter Whites. And our final bit of news, unless you've got anything else. The final bit of news is apparently there's a Ghostbusters animated movie in the works. Paul Feig's live... Is it Paul Feig or Paul Feig?
Feig, I think.
Okay, Paul Feig's live-action reboot is hitting theatres July 15th, 2016. The next step in Sony's growing Ghostbusters universe could be an animated feature film. Internal discussions are underway at Sony Pictures and Sony Pictures Animation to spawn a feature based on the quirky paranormal fighting parapsychologists that originated with the 1984 movie. No writers are on board but it is expected that Ivan Reitman, co-creator of Ghostbusters and one of the stewards of the franchise, would act as one of the producers. Sony Pictures Animated had no comment. Sony recently wrapped production on its all-female-centric reboot of the franchise, with Paul Feig directing. Christine Wilde and Melissa McCarthy are among those starring in the movie that will open on July 15, 2016. Earlier this year, the studio created The Ghost Corps, a collective with Reitman and Dan Aykroyd, to head up the expansion of the franchise and to create a Ghostbusters cinematic universe. Sony is one of the few studios that does not have a mega franchise known as a cinematic universe that can see the making of sequels, prequels, spin-offs, standalones, and whatever else execs can think of. The studio is already in development on a movie that would potentially star Channing Tatum with Joe and Anthony Russo, the duo behind Captain America: The Winter Soldier, to produce and direct it. Ghostbusters was previously translated to the animated form via a popular television series from Dick Enterprises that ran from 1986 to 1991. I just love saying that, Dick Enterprises. D-I-C. Dick.
I watched it. I remember it.
I remember sort of like being really, really underwhelmed with it. I didn't particularly get into it, you know. I liked the film. I liked the first film, but the second film was kind of meh. And, you know, so, you know, to be honest, I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't really care.
I don't care either. I may rent the movies or not even bother. I'm not sure which. I'm certainly not going to the theater for them, whatever else I do.
But the fact that they made it all female-centric is maybe care even less. You know, if they bought it back with Dan Aykroyd and the other guys, I might have indulged it. Or if they bought it back with a new male cast, I might have indulged it. But it's not something that I'm going to sort of like trip over my own shoelaces in haste to get to the theatre to go and see.
It's just not a universe that meant enough to me one way or the other. In the grand scheme of things. I mean, like you said, the original was fun. The second one was still fun, but not quite as good. And, you know, the animated series by Deke was passable, but not brilliant. And, you know, I never felt like this was a universe that needed to be continued, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, I think they did all they could with the first two films. I mean, they did all they could with the first film, and the second film was kind of, you know, but yeah, I mean, I'd personally like to see Gremlins go to a franchise.
That would be cool.
You know, because that's sort of like that's a film series that I do care about. But yeah, that's about all the news we've got. Raisa, I'd like to thank you for joining us. We're actually going to go for the interview right now with Simeon Aston. You know, we'll be back with you after this. I'd like to welcome Simeon Aston to the show. He's the he's one of the creators of a brilliant comic book called Metal Made Flesh. Simeon, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Well, first off, how did you meet with writer Jeremy Biggs, and how did Metal Made Flesh come about? Because Jeremy, in our correspondence, he says that Metal Made Flesh was actually your idea.
Yeah, I had been doing some sort of concept art way back in sort of 2005, and I just kind of started building like just ideas and the three main characters sort of fleshing them out, and I did my own kind of little sort of novella. It was called Hunters, and I never actually published it really. I made a few copies of it, about 30 copies, and you know, just gave them to friends and stuff like that. But it didn't really go anywhere because, you know, there wasn't much of a story to it. And then later, I think 2011, went to a convention in London, I think MCM, I think it was, and I met Jeremy. He was doing a table there with the zombie bears that he also does. And we just, like, he really liked the artwork, and like I was explaining to him that, you know, that I had that sort of an eye, and you know, but the story wasn't really there. So we kind of sort of teamed up, and together we kind of fleshed out the characters. Because the original story, we still haven't even got to that point yet. So, I mean, the book that we released 2 years ago is basically the origin story of the three main characters. So when we first got together, we decided to go back first and actually flesh out these characters before we actually tell the actual main story.
Cool.
Yeah, just went from there, really. So it started off as just you know, just some ideas and some characters that I was kind of sort of knocking about sort of in the world. But yeah, so now we kind of sort of brought it to a much more kind of, like, you know, much meatier, sort of more interesting kind of story and world.
So how's the collaboration between you and Jeremy worked? I mean, obviously you do the artwork, but with it being your creation, you've got to have so much, you've probably got, you know, had so much to contribute in regards to story as well. But how does that work between the two of you?
I have kind of like, you know, the characters, I have kind of like a sort of idea of, you know, what they can and can't do and what the limitations of the world are and things like that. And we basically just bounce ideas off each other. You know, we'll just have like a Skype conversation or send emails and stuff like that. And I've always had like this sort of basic concept of the characters and the world and stuff like that, and together we kind of just make it, you know, just flesh it out, make it more kind of like more interesting and expand upon it, basically.
Mm-hmm. So what can you tell us about the world of Metal Maid Flesh? Because it's sort of like it's cyberpunk, you know, and I've got to tell you, you know, as I said earlier on, I was looking at the artwork that you posted of the comic, and it just looks absolutely phenomenal. It's just, you know, it's really eye-popping.
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of set, obviously, like, in the far future. The humans have kind of been chased sort of to the brink of extinction. They lost a big war against the a race called the Vale, and got pretty much wiped out. So the remnants of the human race on this planet, known as Tuaroni or Ekinias, and it's basically like a very hostile, foggy kind of neon sort of lit sort of world. And the humans are very low on the sort of social ladder and stuff like that. So it's basically just the tagline is like survival is everything. So I mean, these three characters, Isabel, Cleon, and the prince, Tannen, we basically sort of follow their story of how they kind of they rise up and change to become these new characters that we find them at. And basically the world is kind of like very harsh, so you have to be brutal, or you have to, you know, various things to survive in it. It's kind of very much sort of the jungle kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
but in the cyberpunk world.
So is it kind of like your heroes are actually hacking in with inferior technology to the more oppressive regime?
I wouldn't say they're heroes. They're probably more anti-heroes. I mean, initially, like, because we're still kind of in sort of phase one in the first book with their origin stories, it's kind of like the characters, they start off all as kind of either sort of doing things out of desperation, or they are kind of corrupted already, and they kind of go deeper onto the dark side.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of, I mean, this is obviously sort of very science fiction, kind of post-apocalyptic. What things would you say have been the most inspirational to informing your story?
Probably movies and like production design. I mean, when I was younger, I was at college, and most of my inspiration for artwork came from artists kind of like Peter Geiger and Sid Mead and Dali and things like that. I was very much interested in the sort of more surreal and sort of science fiction sort of worlds and things like that, and just how you can make things, everyday objects and things like that, put a little twist on them to make them seem very alien or like futuristic and stuff like that. Films like Blade Runner, Alien, and like anime, things like Ghost in the Shell and Akira and things like that, you know, heavily inspired, like Mobius, and artists like that, things like that. It all kind of like it's very easy to spot in the work, and it's kind of like that's where a lot of my inspiration has come from.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that general feel of that sort of work is kind of like very much is what I like to see the Melt My Flesh as, sort of that kind of same sort of mood and tone of those kind of movies and that sort of artwork and those artists and things like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, once you get to being able to expand these characters in the future issues of the book, is there any plans beyond that? Say, you know, potential, because from what I've seen, certainly there's potential for sort of like taking it into other forms of media, such as video games or animated, you know, cartoon and stuff like that. Would that be something that you'd both like to sort of like see probably happen?
Yeah, I mean, we're always kind of looking things with a few things and like that we've been talking about doing and talking to the various people about maybe doing like an animation, maybe even like doing like a short sort of 15-minute sort of trailer of sorts, either animated or maybe even live action. To take it into different forms of media and maybe video games as well. I mean, I think it'd be kind of a good sort of free roaming type sort of game with the characters and like the nature of the characters in the world and stuff like that. It would be quite good vehicle for a computer game.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we're always up to that sort of thing, for expanding it. As long as we like to keep it sort of true to, you know, to the original concept and stuff like that, we, you know, not really inclined to sweeten it up or make it you know, more kind of kid friendly or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What are your hopes for the sequel? Because you know, and I do know that you know you've both been looking at a sequel, which is going to be called Blood and Oil, if you can get it off the ground. Where do you hope the characters will go in that sequel? And you know.
Well, the Blood and Oil is kind of like just expanding the universe and kind of, because we've already in the first book we kind of established the characters, three main characters, and Blood and Oil is going to kind of like sort of expand the world a little bit more and just tell a few short stories introducing a few other characters, and then after that looking to maybe start the original story that I explained before. I had the original concept and story in mind. So hopefully we should start to get into the beginnings of that, and that's where kind of like would come in, where we kind of like would just continue to expand the world and introduce new factions and new races and things, and then there would be, you know, the main sort of story plot that all these different factions and characters would all be kind of like sort of interlinked in a much sort of much bigger sort of grander story. So this is kind of like the, you know, just the origin sort of thing, just setting the scene. So we're still in that phase at the moment, really.
In some of the literature that I've read, it's, you know, it's kind of compared to Game of Thrones. You know, how would you say it's similar to something like Game of Thrones? I mean, obviously, if this is set in the future, that's sort of like the only thing that probably differentiates it, right?
Well, like I said, I mean, it's just basically what we're looking to do is to expand it and make it so it's our own kind of like sort of where there'd be different factions and different characters and races and stuff. And we were basically going to expand the story and you know, make all these different characters and elements sort of come into play and into a sort of interwoven sort of plots and things like that. So I mean, that's kind of where we kind of sort of draw comparison with like Game of Thrones. We're heading to a sort of bigger, grander story, very similar to where the Game of Thrones is expanded.
Mm-hmm. Are you both fans of Game of Thrones?
Oh yeah. I've been watching it since the start. Big fan, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I can, you know, just as a side note out of interest, what are your feelings about Game of Thrones kind of now that it's, you know, the TV series is kind of like they don't have any more of the novels to actually produce. So are you excited about what they're going to do with that? Or?
Yeah, I think if they run out of novel, then I think it's time to kind of looking at maybe doing the last season or not, or two seasons. I don't think it's gone too long. It's always been building towards a big war. I think it's a great show. I really like it. I just hope they don't try and sort of extend it for too long. I think it needs to come to a head at some point in the next season or two.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that it don't go beyond the two seasons now myself, because I think if it does, it's just gonna completely spoil the whole thing. And it'll fall into go into dangerous territory of becoming a parody of itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's from one thing that immediately grabbed my eye in the write up that you guys have got on the comic, is that there's some comparison to Game of Thrones, because I like that whole world. How you got all these different factions, and and some factions are maybe having to form very uncomfortable alliances in order to sort of get one over, and the other factions, and this and that. It just makes for an interesting read, as well as interesting visuals as well. So.
I think when there's that conflict, it's always for a reason. It's not just the good guys versus the bad guys, and there aren't really any good guys or bad guys in Game of Thrones. It all depends on sort of their point of view of the characters. They all are trying to do their own thing, and they've got their own motives and incentives and things like that. It's a very rich tapestry of characters, they're all kind of after different things for different reasons, but it's all kind of leaning towards the same sort of goal. So it's kind of interesting. It's a really well-written show.
Yeah, I mean, Joffrey wasn't exactly a redeeming character. but even Daenerys in Game of Thrones, she started off quite innocent, and as she's moved along, she's had to do some things, do some terrible things in order to sort of, retain her balance of power and whatnot.
Yeah, she seems to be one of those characters where you can see that it'd be quite interesting to see whether she retains that sort of innocence and sort of her kind-hearted sort of nature, or maybe because she's, like you said, she's having to make some little tough choices. So, you wonder if down the line she might snap and turn into a much more kind of sort of evil character. She might break or have a heartbreaking or something, and then that will just turn her into a much more sort of fearful character, as opposed to the sort of deity that they kind of sort of followers are kind of looking at. So it's a great show. There's lots of great stuff in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should imagine from your point of view as well. I can see why you'd be inspired by it, because it's like this, there's so much going on. Have you done any other? What work did you do before you went into comics? I've just read something. You were a tattoo artist.
It was only a very short spell, just for 6 months. I just trained in Brighton, I did about half a dozen tattoos on people, just very small things bits of tribal work and hammer and sickle and just roses and things like that. I think I did a punk band, I forget the name, they've got a skull, sort of cartoony skull. I think Misfits, I think it was. I did one of those. It wasn't really something that I eventually decided that it just wasn't really something I really wanted to pursue full time. With tattooing, you've got to jump in with both feet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I just wasn't really committed enough. Plus, I had a bit of a falling out with the guy that was sort of teaching me. He had a few problems. I don't think he was on very good terms with the other tattooists in the area and stuff like that. So yeah, it was kind of a little bit stressful working there at times. Mm-hmm. That kind of came to a head.
Yeah, so what sort of, I'm kind of interested in a little bit here, because I've had a couple of tattoos done in recent years, and I'm just wondering, do you actually need to be really good at art to do tattoos? Because I've noticed that when they did my wolf, they kind of did it was kind of like a stencil, and it was just going over the lines.
There's obviously you need to have quite a bit of drawing talent to do it. It's mostly about a steady hand, and you need to know and then you really have good control over the machine, because you've got to get the depth of how deep the needle goes in and things like that. But yeah, because obviously, a lot of tattooists pretty much always use stencils and things like that, so they are basically just tracing. But you need to know what you're doing and other things as well. So I don't think you could go into it with zero drawing talent and stuff like that. But yeah, it depends. It's a difficult one to explain, really. I'm not sure how you would answer that, but yeah, you do definitely need. Some sort of idea of what you're doing on
tattooing. I've got a little drawing talent. I've got a GCSE grade D in art, but I don't think that'd be good enough to do tattoos somehow.
Well, if you can draw, some people say, "Oh, I can only draw a stick man," but I always think that if you do some lessons like that, if you can hold a pen, you can draw. I'd say just need to practice at it. Some people have natural talent for it from the start, but you always have to sort of progress and learn stuff like that. Nobody picks up a pen and instantly able to do a really good drawing. You have to learn, and some people start a little bit ahead than others.
So in terms of the comics, has this been your first comic book experience as an artist? Or?
I've been doing bits and bobs for loads of different things. I do a local Brighton magazine, BN1 magazine. I do the covers for those guys. I've been doing that for a couple of years. Also, I did a few comic strips for Future Quake. On it a few years ago, about 10 years ago now, it's just quite a long time. I think that was one of the first things I had published. Aside from the tattooing, I've just been doing a few sort of freelance bits of that sort of commission and portraits and bits of cover art and paintings and things like that for various people, various projects. I've done a few things for DVD cover design for, I think, Ashen's Quest, which was kind of like a sort of online sort of YouTube parody film that they did. I did the cover for those guys. But yeah, I think Metal Made Flesh has been the main project that I'm kind of sort of known for, and it's the one that's probably definitely the one I put the most work into. The origins of it go back to 2005. It's been my main project.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any aspirations to actually do any comic book work for, say, some of the big companies? You got Marvel, you got DC, and I'd even say you got Dynamite, because Dynamite do some pretty cool stuff with the old pulps. But I'm just wondering, as an artist, is there a character, an established comic book character, that you'd love to do a comic book story for, or are you just happy doing your own stuff?
I'm not sure, really. I'd have to think about that one. I'd like to continue with my flesh and maybe do more sort of comic book works with that. I don't know, given the choice, I can't think of anyone. And if you don't do something with a Star Wars character, maybe a Boba Fett story or something like that, that'd be cool. I think mainly I enjoy doing my own kind of work, or my own representation of something else. Cyberpunk version of a character or something like that. Put my own sort of twist on it. That would be kind of interesting to do.
What advice would you have for those that whether they're artist or writer wanting to get into comics?
I think the best thing to do really is just build a nice portfolio of work, and just include your best stuff. Obviously, going to conventions is that's where I kind of I've got most of my best contacts and things like that. Go to conventions, have your work on your phone or in the portfolio. Show if you want to do comics, then you need to show that you can do comics in the sense that you can do socials make it sort of bold and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the best advice I've been given was just you have to make your work stand out. So, so, say, for example, if someone was looking at a spreadsheet with, like, you know, 50 different sort of pictures, you want their eye to go to your force.
Mm-hmm. And finally, where can people get hold of the first comic, you know, Metal Maid Flesh?
All Metal Maid Flesh goodies are available now at metalmaidflesh.com. We've got a new website at the shop there, and you can get prints, t-shirts, all the books that we, you know, are still available. A few are sold out. We still have a few of the original copies and the Infection comic that we did, as well as the main book. Okay. So yeah, metalmaidflesh.com. That's all your Metal Maid Flesh needs.
Cool. Well, you know, it's been great speaking to you, Simeon, and you know, the best of luck with it. You know, I feel like it just looks totally awesome to me.
Thank you.
That was comics artist Simeon Aston talking about the comic book Metal Maid Flesh. I do believe they're actually working on a sequel to it at present, and I got a feeling that there'll probably be a Kickstarter campaign for that in the weeks to come. Next week we've got an interview lined up with the director of a film that did the festivals a couple of years back, and it's actually coming out on DVD real soon. It's called Blood Punch. The film centres on a young man who's lured into a dangerous love triangle that begins to take a series of shocking and grisly supernatural turns. It's kind of a horror comedy. It kind of dips into several genres all at once, and it's quite a dark and funny film. And it was, you know, and we've been speaking to the director, Madeline Patson, who's probably more well known for her work on children's animated shows, because she works for Disney, but this was pretty much her directorial debut. So we'll be bringing you that interview with Madeline Patson next week. Anyway, thanks as always for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll be back with you at the same time next week. So, bye for now.